Welcome to The Life Hustle. My name is Emer.
And I'm Vivian.
Yeah, and we are in the studio today recording episode 9. Can you believe we're at episode 9 already? Thank you to everyone who has been listening and sending us lovely feedback. We'd love to hear from you all. We're on social media as The Life Hustle across Instagram and Facebook. And we set this up day one because we wanted to use social media for some social good. We were a little bit tired of all the perfect feeds and, you know, our lives didn't match up with that. And we were meeting people in real life through our own work, through the agency, who maybe had a little bit of anxiety, and a lot of it stemmed back, especially with the youth, and it stemmed back to feeling that their lives didn't match these perfect social media images. So we kind of wanted to lift the veil a little bit and just sit down with people in real life, have some real conversations, and we've kind of uncovered amazing stories of resilience and people having, you know, maybe non-conventional career paths and people doing things with their lives that maybe weren't the popular choice, and it's worked out for them. So it's about, you know, finding your own path, not being afraid to do what you want to do, and working hard and just
hustling.
Yes, we love it.
Our favorite word.
Yeah, the most overused word on this podcast for sure. So just a quick shout out before we start to Carol Ruan. Thank you for your feedback. She loved the episode with Jean Noonan. Thanks for listening, Carol. And Rachel Yelverton sent us a lovely message about the episode after that with Pam and Natasha discussing their careers in fashion. She was saying she would have loved to listen to a podcast like that back when she was 18 herself. So we love all the feedback. Keep listening and let us know who you'd like to hear. If you know anyone with a super interesting story, we do love the chats. So please send them our way and we'll get them on a podcast. So our guest today is someone that we have been dying to sit down in the studio with. We both admire her so much. Little girl crush we have. So she is now into her fifth year as the artistic director of Cork's Everyman Theatre. She's a very well-known figure in Cork in the arts. Julie, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you guys. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, you've always, I've read anyway, you know, that you have always been interested in performance, and you started out at a very young age, like lots of kids do, going to dance, doing drama. So you kind of grew up in that environment.
I did, yeah. So like, I think when I was really small, my mum, I was the eldest, my mum used to let me stay up late when my dad was working nights. And there was always things like when the Royal Variety Performance was on, or like things like, you know, musicals, like those are the kind of things. So I think she really
exposed you to those,
like, for that. Yeah. Totally. And you know, when we were like, you know, there's loads of gas stories of me, like, you know, entertaining random strangers on the beach on holiday,
singing songs
at them and this kind of crack. So there was always,
it started early,
some sort of need to be like, you know, give me attention. But yeah, in school we had Margot Carlyle was our drama teacher at school, and we had, wow, you know, the opportunity to did disco dancing for years, which I adored.
You can still bust a move or two.
Yeah, well, like, you know, at least I'd like to think I can.
Please head over to our Instagram page to see Julie busting a disco move.
And I suppose I think I started off with, you know, elocution, because that maybe that was sort of,
yeah, we all did that, didn't we?
I had a lisp.
I didn't.
As well when I was,
maybe I should.
I you worked out grand, girl.
Yeah, but my, and I think my mum was always trying to get the Corky accent out of me, like,
okay.
So I was supposed to, yeah. Now I've rounded out my vowels. But yeah, so and I went on then in secondary school to Marion Wyatt's classes in Turner's Cross, and sort of found a bit of a tribe there, which was brilliant. And when I was approaching doing my leaving cert, I guess I, you know, was always like an avid reader, so I just figured I would study English. But the drama degree came on in UCC just the year that I was, you know, so they were taking their first group of students in September 2001.
Okay.
So
that was meant to be.
Yeah, it was amazing. Perfect timing, actually. And so I decided I put that like top of my list, and I got the points to do that, which was brilliant. And you had to do like an audition and an interview and things as well. But I think I had learned through like doing the classes, particularly like in when I was kind of 16, 17, 18, that like I have a very busy mind, you know.
Okay.
And like I find the kind of the practical elements of drama and theatre so occupying that they make me very, I get
focus,
very focused.
Kind of, okay.
So I thought, well, that's like, that's got to be the key to
perfect
like
for you.
Getting 3 years down at college, you
okay.
know.
Okay.
Great.
And it's amazing to do something in college that you're so passionate
totally,
about.
Totally. And I knew, you know, like it certainly wasn't, my parents weren't thrilled with the idea of me doing this at college.
I was just going to say, like, you know, even now you'd come across a lot of people who maybe, you know, it must be very hard as a parent now, I think. I have to work more on letting my kids be them and follow their own path and not project onto them what I think is best for them. You know, it'll come from a place of love if I do, but, you know, we're only looking out for them. But I do still come across an awful lot of people who want to do something particular in college, and they'll be met with the old saying at home of, but you can't get a job in that, yeah. trying to monetize everything yeah. rather than do what you love doing.
And I suppose if you're a parent, it's about, like, you want your child to be secure, have some prospect yes, exactly. of security
it's
in their
scary.
Life. And I can understand that, like, completely. But I think even more so, that's whatever, 18 years ago now since I started college.
Okay.
God. but even like now more than then, like everyone's in a sort of more precarious position work-wise. Like the
Definitely.
Kind of thing of a permanent job isn't mm-hmm. really a thing yeah. anymore in the way it was for my parents, you know.
Okay.
So the
job
and it's
for
funny
like,
actually yeah. I listened to Vogue Williams at a conference on Friday, and she went to do quantity surveying in college.
Wow.
Which was a big shock to me, and her stepfather was really strict and wanted her to, you know, get a secure career path. And she just started acting and loved it, and was talking to RT about all these different scripts. And he was very much against it.
Yeah.
But then the recession hit and the whole building thing fell, you know, fell down. And
yeah.
And he was like, OK, just give it a go. And, you know, look at her now. She's,
yeah.
you know, making documentaries
exactly.
all over the world.
Exactly.
And you actually, Julie, you've worked in all aspects of theatre since you graduated. What's the area that you get the most kind of fulfillment and joy out of?
Oh, like there's loads of things really. Like, I suppose when I came out of college first, I maybe, even though I didn't have an aspiration going into college to be an actor, that's what I did a little bit more of that, I guess.
Okay.
Coming out of, so like the first paid job I had out of my degree before I even had finished my exams was working with Karkadarka as an actor.
Brilliant.
It was kind of extraordinary. I was like, oh my God, can't believe it.
Amazing.
Look, Mom, I'm getting paid to do the thing. So I did that for a little bit, but I suppose over a number of years, that became really challenging for me, again, because I have such a busy mind. When you're an actor, you're waiting for someone sort of to give you a gig.
Okay.
And I find, you know, the kind of waiting or this time and space in between, like, I'm not good with that.
It's a limbo.
Like, stay going.
Be busy. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, I think, probably why I ended up being a producer, though I have directed as well. And I think now, maybe more than ever, even though I've, you know, dabbled in all sorts of things, you know, I really feel that the producing side of things is where I'm in my right place.
Okay.
You know,
you found your way there.
Because I have loads of power.
Evil laugh.
But it does, you know, afford me the opportunity to sort of generate work or to initiate things in
okay.
a way that you can't do when you're an actor.
Waiting for work to come in.
You know?
Yeah.
True. And how do you find, you know, even we find in our industry, you know, it is a small city, but it's one of the most beautifully cultural cities. Like, we're ridiculously proud of so many lovely things, you know, culturally that happen here on our own doorstep. But Viv and I would feel like we would be bursting to produce a lot more events ourselves, mm-hmm. From even a community aspect of getting people in our industry together, because we know how financially beneficial that can be and how, you know, encouraging it can be to work with like-minded people, but the money isn't there a lot of the time. Do you have challenges in your industry from a funding point of view? You know, do you get to do, like, is it very much dependent on budget?
Absolutely. It absolutely is. So, like the Everyman is a kind of a great asset in one sense because it has 650 seats. So if you got the right show or the right gig, like, you can actually really, you know, earn money from it, which is brilliant, as opposed to maybe somewhere smaller like the Cat Club, where there's a ceiling because there's only 100
the size,
seats,
yeah.
you know.
Okay.
So that will dictate the scale of the kind of thing that you can produce.
And is that something you have to, like, when you're programming, do you have to keep that in mind,
yeah.
I suppose, with yeah. such an iconic big venue in Cork?
Absolutely. Now, like, the Everyman is publicly subsidised. So about 8% of our turnover annually is public subsidy.
Okay.
So there's a little bit of
breathing,
you know, buffer
space
there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that means that we can do, like, much riskier work that, you know, that's a little bit more maybe experimental, or that's, like, dealing with subject matter that's a bit more challenging, that isn't necessarily going to bring in the hordes of people.
But it might bring new people to
exactly,
theatre.
And it's always really important work. It's kind of like, you know, it's like what she says in The Devil Wears Prada about the, you know, the colour blue.
Oh yeah.
Like, you know, it's that sense of it sort of trickling down
yes.
into kind of the wider consciousness, you know,
mm-hmm.
so that I think that work is, in all kind of art forms, you know, things
it's
that
important.
Are a bit more experimental, it's really important
okay.
to have a place for that. And, you know, so that, like, I always think about it as a kind of, in terms of appetite, you know what I mean? So that, like, okay, you don't want to eat like burger and chips every day. You know, yes, you might want to have something a little
broaden
bit more,
the horizons,
yeah,
a little
totally
bit. Okay. After the incredibly successful run then of the stage version of Louise O'Neill's play Asking for It, you were quoted as saying that as much as 60% of the audience had never come to the Everyman before. That really stood out for me. What an amazing thing to do.
Yeah. And it's actually, I saw a lot of people online going to that and really buzzed up about it. Like loads of people that I know wouldn't have gone to plays before. And, you know, it was really interesting.
Yeah. Like that's like it's kind of the holy grail, like for
brilliant
me in terms
the
of
highlight
my role
for you.
It is, absolutely. Because like that's what you're all about, you know, and like I suppose the received wisdom would be that like, oh, the Everyman audience is a little bit older and maybe a little bit fusty and okay, that kind of thing, you know. So part of what you're trying to do is to try and grow an audience and develop it so that they stay with you over time. And I suppose when we thought about doing it, I didn't necessarily have that in mind as a mm-hmm.
as a goal.
I just thought like that was a really important piece of work that needed to be made. Mm-hmm. That was the
such an important subject at the time.
Yeah.
And why do you think people don't feel theatre is for them? Is it because, you know, is it kind of a class kind of, you know, geography thing? Is it an age thing? Or is it just that, you know, in school it hasn't been, you know, a widely taught subject?
Yeah, I think there's loads of barriers really. Like, so yeah, so that we don't have as much access to it in school in the way that we do maybe to even to sport and music.
Okay.
But I suppose I feel, so when I was a kid, my birthday's in January, so my parents always took me to Panto, right?
Okay.
The Opera House, actually, when I was a kid. And so like, I'd say it was nearly 12 before I realised that other things happened in the theatre that
okay.
weren't Panto.
Oh, wow.
I just thought that was what always happened. So for me, the like, I've never felt not at home in the theatre.
Okay.
So I think if you're a person who doesn't have that contact, so, but I do have the feeling, so in art galleries sometimes, I'm growing out of it now.
Okay.
But when I was younger, when I started college, like I had never really been, I'd maybe been to an art gallery once.
Was it so more of a self-consciousness, like,
it is,
what
you
do,
sort of like, how
do I belong,
how do
here?
I be? How
do I look pensively at the painting?
Yes, like how do I sort of behave in this, you know?
And like you look at the Glucksmann, what a magnificent building, you know, even just to get a coffee, walk around there, it's like, is,
well, we're spoiled with the Glucksmann and the Crawford.
The Crawford,
like, we're,
oh,
absolutely
goodness,
spoiled in Cork City for like extraordinary galleries, and there's more besides, you know.
But I think I do see an awful lot of people, peers and younger people, exploring these galleries,
yeah,
you know, strolling around on a Saturday, and it's becoming a talking point, I think, in social circles.
Definitely.
As well, that it wasn't before.
And it helps, it does help, I think, if as a young person you can feel like, you know, you're allowed in that space and you're allowed to be you in that space, you know, mm-hmm. that really helps. And so I suppose we try to really foster a sense of kind of openness and community at the Everyman to make sure that, you know, we're trying to reach out to as many people as possible, mm-hmm. and say, actually, this is for you, it's all for you, actually.
Okay.
Because, you know,
that's
given
lovely.
That only 8% of our turnover is public subsidy, like literally the other 92% is about people buying tickets.
Of course.
So, like, it really is,
yes,
yeah, all for them, you know.
I'm laughing because I just had a flashback of Erin last year. She was 3 and we went to the Glucksmann just one afternoon, and there was a big, massive piece hanging that was like, it was like an artist's impression. This was chocolate.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, a giant. I mean, it was like ceiling to floor, a piece of
like Nutella. That,
yes.
That one, yeah.
But she licked it. You know, you're saying, I just turned around. She was like, Mom, look at this. Licking. And she was like, it doesn't actually taste like Nutella. So I was like, casually, sweat falling off my forehead, casually going,
backing
right,
back
over here. Let them be them. No, not in that situation.
Can I just ask about the feedback from Louise O'Neill's play?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what was the feedback you got from people?
So, like, you know, we had a few nights of previews, and like, I find it takes me a couple of days to like sort of assimilate what's, you know, what's happening. And my co-producer Anne Clark, who's amazing, like instantly was like, oh my God, it's amazing. We're going to, like, it's going to be, you know, whopper. And like, the sales were already very strong, but like instantly, like the kind of the tweets and, you know,
Are you looking at the technical side now as well? You're worrying about the whole picture.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you just tell
absolutely.
People a little bit about the play?
So the play is based on Louise's book, and it follows the story of a young girl called Emma, who's 18 and who's gang raped at a party one night. It follows the kind of the lead up to that and then the aftermath of that experience. And it's set in a kind of a, you know, small-ish kind of rural town in Ireland. And the boys who rape her are sort of local heroes, I guess. They're, you know, they're GAA players, and I suppose it's all just sort of horribly plausible feeling when you watch it, which is kind of the slightly terrifying thing about it. And it really looks at the violence that's wreaked on her in the first time, but also the kind of second layer of violence, which is about, you know, her being completely ostracised from the community,
the shame,
and her relationship with her parents breaking down because they're not able to cope, or they don't have the language to talk about the thing that's happened to her. So it's really, yeah, it's really hard to watch on one level. And I think even Louise found the experience herself, like, she wrote the book, but when she
bringing it to life,
watched it in person, she found it, I think, really like traumatizing on one level,
of course,
you know?
Yeah,
because there's something, I mean, that's the power of theatre, you know, like to hear something spoken out loud, or it's like a vibration that's in the room, right? So you've got, you know, there might be 600 odd people in the audience and then however many on the stage, but like, you know, it's different than when you're watching a film, because
the energy
those feelings are there and real in the room, you know, and that's the actor's job, is like through body language and voice and text and everything to really give you a sense of that feeling. And it can be extraordinarily powerful when it really works. And I did read one of those
reviews from people who were reduced to tears or were enraged.
But I haven't watched the show yet without crying. Like, I can't go every night, even though I know it's going to happen. Like, I know the story inside out, you know.
Yeah.
But people, I think, like, it took me ages to articulate what it is, but looking at all the tweets and the things that people were saying, I mean, there was some maybe small amount of dissenting opinion, but generally speaking, there was something about the people being gathered together to witness somebody else's pain or witness somebody else's trauma. So that's it. And that's actually really absent a lot of the time from our theatre, because there's not a lot of women's stories on the stage.
True, yeah.
It has historically been, I guess, a pretty male-dominated space in terms of the stories that are being told. So
true.
It was quite an arresting thing, I think, for people to sit and, as I say, bear witness to that.
And to kind of jump in on that topic then, like, if we go back, say, to 2015, where for our listeners at the Abbey Theatre in Dublin, they announced their new season for 2016, and it was called Waking the Nation. The season had 18 men on the programme in terms of writers and directors, but just two women. Yeah. And all of the plays bar one were written by men. So a historic public meeting at the time was kind of held in the Abbey Theatre on the 12th of November 2015, where women stood on the Abbey stage and they shared their stories about the great work that they were making and the continuous discrimination that they faced. And from that, hashtag Waking the Feminists was born. Now, you have been a great kind of champion of Waking the Feminists. Yeah. Can you tell me the difference now that you, since then, I guess, that you've seen in the industry?
Well, so like kind of on a personal level, like when I started the job at the Everyman, one of the things that I was really keen to do was to produce more work that had more roles for female actors, because, you know, having come from an acting background, I could, you know, like, feel the gap, you know.
Okay.
But I hadn't thought at all about playwrights or directors, being perfectly honest. And so when Waking the Feminists kind of landed, and like there was all of this kind of conversation about, you know, I was really struck. I was like, oh my God, like, I think I'm such a feminist, and I've been like worrying about this thing over here and completely forgetting about these other elements, and I was kind of horrified.
Okay.
I was, you know, at my own oversight, if you like. So I was trying to really make a conscious effort to change that, and to and to not be, you know, I mean, you could kind of call it forgetful, but like, you know, really it was oversight, you know. So try to be better at thinking about things in a more rounded way.
Okay.
So like Asking for It is a direct result of that process. In the sense that our co-producer Anne Clark from Landmark, there was a follow-up meeting about 6 months after the one that you described in the Abbey, and it was Anne was at that, and she'd also just won an award at the Irish Times Theatre Awards, and I thought, oh, like, we can't make it by ourselves, it's too big, like, we need somebody who really knows what they're doing to help us to do it if that's to happen. And I think I pitched that to her, and it was the perfect moment for it, because she was really at that point, I think she was also examining maybe what her back catalogue looked like at Landmark. And so they've produced loads of amazing work by Enda Walsh, for example.
Yes.
But like, you know, on a sort of on a numbers basis, then there is a kind of dominance of the male voice there a little bit. So she was really keen to strike
the timing was really good.
It was. Yeah. Okay. But like, but also definitely that whole process has informed that. And like, you can see now, like, even this, like, so I've been to three plays in Dublin in the last fortnight.
Okay.
all of which have been written by women.
Fantastic.
Wow, you know, so that's definitely fantastic. And like, they're all brilliant as well.
Yeah.
You know?
That's the point.
Oh, sorry. And there's a fourth that's on that I haven't seen, but it's coming to the Everyman in May. So
okay.
Actually there's four pieces of theatre on in Dublin at the moment.
That you can just pick from the top of your head now, which was not the case before. And absolutely. And I was going to say, like, that's like, it's not about filling a quota for the sake of filling a quota. No. It's about finding equally talented people in the field that maybe women, you know,
absolutely.
As well. Because the Arts Council of Ireland in 2016, they did fund the commission to do the research document into gender balance in Irish theatre. And they found, which I thought was so interesting, that the higher the funding received, the lower the female presence at the time. That only 28% of authors employed were women, and only 9% of sound designers employed were women as well. So that then resulted in the code of behaviour in the industry. Do you think people adhere to that, or that it's considered more now?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things that have happened. So yeah, Irish Theatre Institute have written this brilliant code of behaviour document, and they consulted really widely on that, and it's excellent. And like, I know for sure. And then, so then there was this other process that kind of in parallel that I was involved with, along with the likes of Dublin Theatre Festival and Druid Theatre Company and the Abbey, which was about us and the Lair, who did a brilliant job on that too. So like, about writing policy documents basically you know, that were specifically with regard to gender and gender balance, but also like, so incorporate things like kind of bullying and harassment, you know, which might exist, but this is more specific.
So it's more than an awareness, it's actually putting it into practice and putting a manner on it.
And the other thing, I suppose, that like became really clear when I was like digging in, like doing research on those policies, is that it's actually not just about gender at all. Like, we need to be looking at ethnicity and class and race and sexuality, and you know,
so it just lifted
that.
The veil on other topics that really needed a bit of modernization.
Yeah. And you'd think in 2019, you know, that we've come so far, like, as women, that it's amazing that that's still happening.
I know, but I think about when I was in college, and I thought, like, we did a lot of kind of French feminist theory, you know, which is pretty heavy going, like, and I remember like being allergic to it and going, like, I don't know that stuff. Like, I can do what I want. Like, I'm here, I've got an education, I'm grand. And only kind of like, you know, the penny slowly dropping as you get older, and you kind of go,
you get out into the workplace, and
and you realize actually, like, it's very different. So,
and it's such important work to be doing for the future generations as well.
Yeah.
You know, it is.
And I think it's like, well, obviously not alone the things that have happened in terms of Waking the Feminist, but obviously the whole Me Too thing broke then in that intervening time before Asking If It Happened. And then there was like the Belfast trial was happening at the same time as well.
Goodness.
So there does feel like a kind of a mounting, doesn't there?
Yes.
You know, kind of pressure for change, or,
absolutely,
you know, where people maybe just aren't afraid to speak out anymore. And with things like the referendum last year, we've seen extraordinary change in the last few years, I think, really.
I know. And even like, I feel there's a huge interest in youth activism at the moment with the climate change protests, school children out protesting. And you know what? It's great to see. I know some people kind of do eye roll over it. But, you know, sometimes it's grassroots attitudes and changes at grassroots
100%.
Level.
And I think it's amazing, you know, that the possibility for change. Like, I'm a fierce letter writer. I do write to my TDs all the time.
Oh, good woman. Good woman.
Particularly about the Eighth Amendment over the years, like, you know, those kinds of things, because I do believe in the kind of process around that, you know, because I don't think it's good enough to kind of say, oh, well, I can't change anything anyway. I think, you know, if everybody took small actions,
that is,
you
know, such an important
climate change, it's harder.
Like, I know,
it is more than just like individual actions there, because they're such big, you know.
But it's true. It's so important for people, especially young people, to realise that, as you said, you can't just look at a problem and say, well, look, sure, my little life here isn't going to change, or my view. Yeah. Like, all
the
it
changes
takes
in the last few years have, you know, it's proof that we can do it. Yeah. You know,
all it takes is a powerful voice and other powerful voices coming together. Yeah. Love.
I just want to congratulate you on your recent wedding
to
Mick. I met you the morning of your wedding in a bit of a panic in Origin Hair Design. Yeah, with your gorgeous mom. Tell us a little bit about your day. It was so Cork. I love it.
We were very on brand. Well, I stayed the night before in the Imperial, actually, which was gorgeous. So, and I did the brilliant, most brilliant thing. So I snuck, snuck out. There was nobody else there. Mick stayed in his mum's. But like, I just went off by myself for the morning and went to have my breakfast in the Crawford Cafe.
That's stunning. So lovely.
Dreamy.
Oh my God, nobody on you. I love it.
And then I went to Argent to get my hair done. So we did that, and we left from the Imperial, and we got married in St. Peter's on North Main Street, and they looked after us brilliantly there.
Awesome.
We had a gorgeous humanist celebration there, and loads of our friends friends contributed to the kind of readings and singing all that. Because Mick is Mick and I met playing music together.
Okay,
You were in a band.
Yeah. Mick plays the drums, and he still is working with that band. And
can we please come to your house for a sing song some night?
Sure.
Let's give him a plug. What's the band?
Ocean Six.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah.
One of the busiest bands out there.
Absolutely. So, and when I got the job on The Everyman, I had to kind of put that to one side because they're so, so busy, like they're maybe 100 nights in the year.
Did you get them to play at the wedding at any stage?
We didn't. His dream was to have the Lynch Mob play at the wedding. So that's what we had.
Oh, that's fab.
Yeah, so we went then after St. Peter's over to Jacob's on the Mall, and the brilliant Tricia Lewis and Neil looked after us there all night. And we had the Lynch Mob.
What a gorgeous venue.
It's amazing. Gorgeous. Venue. Like, it's so special. And we were stuffed. There was 150 of us rammed in there. It was brilliant. Yeah. And then
imagine
we had Stevie
atmosphere.
G playing us out till the wee hours.
Isn't it so nice to look back at your wedding and say it was the best party celebration with family and friends?
And you did exactly what you wanted to do.
Yeah. And like, Mick wouldn't, you know, have been. Like, he was a bit apprehensive, I guess, about, you know, about the big day. Like,
ceremony.
Not about the being
I think when you're in the industry, you can be like that, you know.
And we had seen bajillion weddings because that's what we did. And so we had very clear ideas about what we didn't want to do and about how we wanted it to go. And so, like, the thing of it being a big party was, you know, there was a big emphasis placed on that. I'm sure he had a ball, like, on the day in the end. But, I spoke after dinner and remember, you know, it was a big long list of thank yous, but saying the biggest thank you really was to Mick, who sort, because it was a gift, you know, to give me really that, to have that celebration and have everybody there, because that, you know, that was very important.
Brilliant. That's and so then lovely. You jetted off to California.
We flew to San Francisco and spent a couple of weeks driving around in a big gas guzzling convertible.
Wow, that is the dream.
I adore that you bought the dress and you just set the timer and took pictures, the most incredible pictures I've seen.
Amazing.
In
the desert?
In Joshua Tree, yeah. So this was Mick's idea, which he said it to me one night about 2 weeks before the wedding. We were out for dinner and he said, you know, because he had this fabulous tuxedo jacket with kind of orchid print crushed velvet.
Oh, I loved it actually.
Yeah, it was
gorgeous.
Really fab. And so he said, I was thinking, you know, why don't we bring the gear out, like, and take a few pics.
I love him.
I know, I thought it was amazing. I thought, like, number one, I can't believe you're even suggesting this, and number two, that, like, I
like, if you had done it, I'd be like, no.
Yeah, and he was so funny when we were going, we were staying in Palm Springs, like, which is kind of, I suppose, one of the nearest big cities to kind of the main entrance to the, or one of the main entrances to the Joshua Tree National Park. And, like, here I was, like, in my wedding dress. Like, what? He's like, okay, just go ahead now. I'll be behind you. I want to see, like, how people react, you know? Like, it's
did you have people coming
nobody
up to you?
Nobody raised an eyebrow because they see so much mad stuff there all the time. They did bat an eyelid. So he was a bit, like, disappointed with that.
They were incredible.
Yeah, so we spent an hour, going around the desert. Taking selfies. Oh, my God, the state of us. But anyway, the photos are beautiful.
But if you can't do it when you get married, when can you do it?
Yeah. Yeah,
I always say it's one of the only times that everyone is there to celebrate you together.
It's an amazing experience.
It's beautiful. I find it really overwhelming, actually, the walking down the aisle bit and when people turn around and there's, like, all the love, like, pointed at
you,
like a Care Bear rainbow. Is like kind of knocks your block off a little bit, like.
And I kind of hadn't, when we got married, I didn't really think about the church element.
Yeah,
it was, you know, we got married in Glendore in the little church next to the rectory, and I kind of just thought, you know, it was all about the venue after. And the church was so magical. I remember we were sitting facing out to the congregation and I just got so overwhelmed with
your
that feeling of love.
Seeing everyone and people have travelled to see you.
I know, and this love, it's just, they're all there for you. It's just beautiful. Like, you know, it really is a great time. And I hope you still have the honeymoon vibes at home.
Well, I will say, like, that the great thing about being married is that you don't have to plan a wedding because, like,
I know.
You know, like,
it does take over.
It was a busy year
and
last
when you
year
plan
with work
for,
as well. So.
Yeah. What's your work highlight so far?
I think Asking First probably would win that accolade, though we had, like, a number of brilliant projects last year that I'm really, really proud of, and a couple more coming up this summer that we're really excited about as well. So, but I think in terms of, like, that Asking First was so brilliant because it was doing something really important.
Yes.
It was a really brilliant piece of theatre. Like, it didn't sacrifice.
Yes.
Anything in terms of production for the kind of issue it was dealing with, if you like. And because we were able to bring so many people to the theatre for the first time, like, that's, I guess,
amazing.
For me, that's why it sort of, like, just, yeah, wins all of that. So
amazing. And what would you say is your, at the moment, your biggest challenge in your role?
The biggest challenge is, so in the first few years, I suppose I was trying to work really hard to maybe make the Everman a little bit more visible on a kind of national level.
Okay. Do you feel you've achieved that?
I do.
Yeah, I would agree.
And you had a big makeover with branding and everything.
Yeah, on all fronts. So I always say, like, so basically the challenge before was that nobody was looking, and now the challenge is everybody's looking.
Okay, wow. New pressures, I suppose.
Yeah. So that's, but that's an exciting thing as well. You know, yeah. That's an opportunity, I guess. So don't mess it up now.
No pressure.
Is the thing. Yeah.
And the piece you're working on at the moment, all your energy is going into Evening Train. Tell
evening
us a little
train,
bit about that.
Evening Train.
I
can't
just listened to Mick Flannery on
you?
The way out.
It's just so brilliant. Amazing. He's fab, and he's having a brilliant time as well, I think.
Oh, good.
And this process. So I'd been aware for a few years that that Mick and playwright Ursula Rani Sarma were working together to do a version of Evening Train, Mick's album, brilliant debut album, to make it into a stage musical. And I suppose I kind of thought again like that, that we were maybe, or that I was maybe too junior a producer at the Everman, wasn't sort of, you know, a big enough kind of lead production house to take it on. And mm-hmm. I had advised them a couple of years back to maybe look, you know, meet with a couple of other producers. And last January of last year, we tried to get some public funding for it, and we didn't succeed in that, unfortunately. But what did happen out of it was that I built a brilliant relationship with Mick's manager, Sheena, who is the best in the world.
Okay.
And I suppose over the course of the next kind of 9 months or so, we tried various different ways of thinking about it to make it work. And really, at like kind of the 11th hour at the end of last year, we decided that we were, you know, that we would work together to do it, that we didn't need a third sort of bigger producer. So we're co-producing it with Mick and Sheena. And we're in a mad dash now to get a cast, and we'll be presenting it as part of Cork Midsummer Festival for 10 performances. And so there'll be nowhere else to see it this year.
That's amazing.
Brilliant. You know, so
brilliant.
It's obviously world premiere, and it's brilliant. Happening in Cork. So that's, I think that was one of the reasons as well, maybe why, you know, people really came out to support asking for it, because there's something special about having, having a world premiere in your
town,
and and that it's, you know, that it's from the work of Cork artists, in the way that, you know, Louise wrote the original book in Asking For It, and Mick has done the original source material here.
And there will be huge support from me.
And I think it's going to be another piece that is going to bring people to theatre that may not have
100%.
Had a theatre experience.
Yeah, that's it. And I suppose now I'm thinking, like, so if those 60% of people, am I certain that they've had an opportunity? Is there something in the programme that they can
say
they want to come back and see? And so I'm hoping that this might be it in terms of the demographic and in terms of the experience and what people might like to see. So we're really buzzing about it. We go into rehearsal in 3 weeks' time. We're like inches away from finalising the cast. We have a brilliant musical director, brilliant choreographer, brilliant set designer who's from Cork. So like, and so an amazing director as well to kind of like put all the team together. So it's really thrilling. And we've made a number of operas and things like that over the last number of years as well. But this is our first musical proper, though it's maybe not, it's not jazz handsy, I guess, as musicals go. I mean, anyone who knows the album will know it's pretty dark stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So,
gritty, nice gritty.
It is, but there's still kind of a love story at its heart, you know?
Right.
Games of poker and love triangles.
I'm so excited.
All the good stuff, you know.
Before we go, Julie, the one thing that comes across just being in the studio with you here is like your energy. When you speak about what you do, there's like a glint in your eye. Your body language is, you're physically talking with your hands, like it's coming out your pores that you love what you do. Like, how lucky to work in something that's, it's like your natural way that, you know, you just get to do something that you absolutely adore.
Going to work every day.
I laugh. Yeah, I do most days at least anyway. But I refer to myself as a theatre evangelist, you know. Like a lot of times I'm out there trying to convert people.
To knocking on doors.
To the creed. Like, you know what, if I had the time to do it.
Don't
like,
encourage her.
I'd be like, you know what, there's this show in the programme I think you would really like it. You should come try it.
Are you doing
it,
anything right now?
Thing. Yeah, yeah. But
I think it needs somebody young and energetic like you to get people into the theatre.
Because it's an ancient art form, like, you know, and I suppose if you don't know like what to expect or, you know, what it could, what it could be. I mean, that's the trouble too, I suppose, is that maybe people come and see something that isn't brilliant the first time. Okay. And that can be, like, the first time I went to see an opera, I was really excited to go and see it and it was really bad.
Okay.
And I was like, oh no. Everyone talks about it, like, because you know that bit, like, in Pretty Woman where she goes to the opera and she's bawling at the end of it. And I was like,
you didn't have that moment.
Why didn't that happen? It came eventually, you know.
But you can't tire them all with the same brush.
Like, yeah, exactly, exactly. So, I do feel very lucky, not alone to, like, to be in the role that I'm in, but to be at home in Cork and have that role, because, you know, there's
a lot of people have to move away. Yeah, we find that with designers and even models and people.
Yeah, to sustain a career, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
A lot of people have to move to London and...
And you know what? There was a time, I know in our industry, I'm not sure about yours, but where things outside of the capital were seen as being substandard. Mm-hmm. And I think that has changed, thankfully, for us. It's still a process and it's still mm-hmm. something that we work very hard to overcome, but it is changing. People's views and attitudes are changing. The internet has changed it for us.
Definitely.
Theatre, is it the same?
I think so. I mean, like, I feel like... you guys are probably quite similar to me in that I made a really conscious commitment to Cork, you know.
Yes.
And I spent a year working in Dublin and kind of thought, yeah, okay, I could do it, I could stay here and that's fine. But it's a really, really important thing to me to contribute to the cultural community in Cork. Like, that's, you know, I think that's
your
where
passion.
My energies are best placed. And why shouldn't our second city have a really rich cultural life, from sort of mm-hmm. design and fashion and art through to, you know, theatre and performance? Like, you know, who's to say that it is, you know, second rate? Like, it's really not, you know.
So true. Mm-hmm.
And I think it is about the kind of brain drain of people having to move on, because it's really been really difficult to sustain a career. But as you say, you know, with the advent of the internet and things like that, maybe there's a little bit more opportunity. And I think but it's people like you guys, like, digging mm-hmm. in and go, actually, no, like, we're going to make it happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know what, in our last episode with Jack Crotty, the Rocket Man, we were saying that people look at us, like, Viv was at a conference on Friday and people are coming up to her saying, oh, you're flying it at the moment, you're everywhere, and you're as if we're, like, hiding Mercedes at home, you know, out the back. And, like, we're not, you know. And there's some weeks we're like, are we making a wage this week, you know, how are we getting
the reality of creative people,
but we don't give up. And like you know, if you're in really passionate about what you do and if you believe in it, like, we know that all our friends in business, they, you know, they aren't flying it either, but they do what they love and they have to press on, like,
yeah. And it's true. I mean, there is the thing people always say to me, you know, and you love it, and I do, but there are days, you know. I've a really good meme there lately which said something like, you know, find a job that you love and you'll never have any boundaries and you'll never be able to switch anything off, and you'll work every single day of your life. So there is that other side to it too, like,
yes,
that's part of the gig, I guess. So it does become really important, I think, to kind of I'm certainly learning the value of, like, self-care and, you know, managing
switching off.
We're not very good with that, because there has been, I think, since school, with us anyway, you're always trying to prove yourself, and it takes a bit of life experience to be comfortable in yourself to get to a point where you can say, you know, I'm really not worried about perception of me. I'm more into having a fulfilling life, or, you know.
And remember what's important.
Yeah.
Family and friends.
Yeah. 100%. I think having a little bit of time for your own, you know, time for yourself, you know.
Not to burn out.
Completely.
Trying to do everything.
That is a huge challenge, I think, in mm-hmm. the kind of in burnout. Lots of creative careers, you know.
And actually, Stephanie Rainey, the singer, was talking on Friday at the seminar about, she was just literally having her last go at making a music video. Yeah. And she was saying, if this doesn't work, like, I'm done, you know, because mm-hmm. I mean, you can imagine years of trying to make it as a musician.
Yeah.
And the video that she made, like, literally just blew her up. Like, she was just, you know, and that's when her career really took off, you know. And I suppose that's the challenge. You can imagine actors trying to make it for years and years.
But I don't think you really appreciate it unless you, like, I think you have to have the lows. If you have all mm-hmm. the highs, you don't really understand, you know, like, you need the experience of the highs and the lows to really...
Nothing happens overnight.
Yeah, to really value where you are and what you have and to make the most of it, I suppose. We're getting very philosophical.
I'm going off to do some yoga.
Absolutely.
And meditate on
the
cam.
You were in Crosshaven this morning in the sunshine walking.
I was walking in the summer. So yeah, I do find a lung full of fresh air by the sea. Yes. Definitely a tonic. And I have an amazing yoga teacher as well, but I started yoga and I've been earnest maybe 6 months into my role at the Everyman, and it's definitely
lovely.
Your medicine.
So nice.
It absolutely is. You know, I like, you know, you get a physical benefit from it, but I think it's the
connecting with yourself.
It helps me calm it down a little bit.
connecting back with yourself and resetting the batteries, I think. Julie, it's been so lovely to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us. We wish you the absolute best with everything for the rest of 2019 at the Everyman and personally. And we cannot wait to come in for Evening Train.
Oh,
it's going to be brilliant.
We're
going to
make a big night out of that.
I'm really excited about the Midsummer. It's always, it's when I met my husband. So we always try to make a little bit of time to kind of...
It's a lovely time of year.
Go in town, you know, go from little piece to piece and go for a little bit of food. And it's lovely. It's such a great time in the city. So best of luck with all your production and rehearsals and everything, and the castings. And we look forward to seeing you at the Everyman.
Thank you.
Thanks, Julie.